Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. Now I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who was nominated for a Grammy earlier this year for Best Country Song. He makes us sound like angels. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, go to Spotify and look up our playlist, And the Writer Is, or go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on whatever your preferred podcast listening site is, whether it's iTunes or it's one of the others. We appreciate that effort and thank you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's guest is pretty exciting for me. He was actually one of my old booking agents from my band Glacier Hiking. That is before he started writing number one songs. That's right. He was the kind of guy who was writing number one songs on the side. I mean, most of the time when someone tells me that they want to be a songwriter and they're doing some other job, I just assume that songwriting is a hobby for them. But this guy was talented enough that his hobby brought him number one worldwide smashes. So this one we recorded a little bit ago. We did it in the morning, which is why we start this thing eating breakfast. It's pretty much that vibe the whole way. I mean, I've known Evan for about 10 years. And the reality is that I had no idea some of these details in this story. So I'm really excited for you guys to listen and find out the truth about Evan Bogart. But before we get into the actual podcast, I just want to say one thing about Evan. Evan is the guy who's advocating for songwriter rights. He's the one going to DC. He's the one talking to Congress. And he's the one who's vice president of the Grammy Board in Los Angeles. He reminded me a little bit ago that a lot of songwriters are busy advocating for whatever they believe in, which is important, but they need to advocate for themselves and they need to advocate for the community. Because that's how we make a living. And that's how we are able to afford the ability to fight for whatever our interests really are. Now, Evan is a true entrepreneur in the music business. He comes from a tremendous lineage. His father was the founder of Casablanca Records, which had Kiss and Donna Summer, and his mother was Kiss's manager. A few notes for you to follow along. We'll just go through this quickly. Evan's company is Boardwalk Entertainment. He has a partnership with E-Man, which is the creative company. When he talks about Wally, he's talking about Tom Wally, who is the former chairman and CEO of Warner Brothers and former president of Interscope Records. He also talks about JR, who's JR Rotem. He talks about Zach, who's Zach Katz, who's the current president of BMG Music, who also was the co-founder of Beluga Heights with JR Rotem. He talks about Jimmy, who's Jimmy Iovine, the founder of Interscope. He talks about Josh Humiston, who was an agent and a partner at APA, which is an agency. That was where Glacier Hiking, my band that I was earlier talking about, was signed. He talks about Jay Brown, who's the co-founder and CEO of Roc Nation. He talks about Lindy, who's Lindy Robbins, one of the best top liners in the music business. And the rest you can find out as you listen to this episode of And the Writer Is. This is our theme song?
I don't know, man.
I love it. Okay, welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's guest is an industry force. There are a few people who have been as influential from both the creative and business sides as much as this writer has. He's produced television shows and movies, but as he once told me, if he stops writing songs, the house of cards will fall. From Los Angeles, this hitmaker has written huge copyrights and created an impressive multimedia company. Most importantly, he was one of the first to introduce me to writing pop music while he was one of my old band's booking agents. And the writer is my friend and Boardwalk's founder, Evan Kid Bogart. As he enters from the closet. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I brought you bagels.
Yes.
So there are, there's sesame.
Everybody knows I don't talk without bagels.
I mean, that's what they say.
That's just the industry.
Evan's the bagel guy. Yeah. You're the bagel guy. You're like, so there's plain.
We don't mean that obviously in like an anti-Semitic way either, obviously.
No.
Not like he's bageling or something. It's not like.
Right. Well, I mean, I think.
Oh, I heard that term.
Jewish
I heard that
star,
term.
Star that you have on your yeah, chest right now.
That's is different. Sort of
like, you know? But yeah, here, help yourself, and then I'll eat one of them too. But we got egg in there and sesame and everything, and then there's chive and there's regular cream cheese.
What did you think I was going to have?
Maybe you'll be an everything thing, or you'll surprise me with an egg and be like, you know what? When it comes to food, I'm simple. Hey, pass that.
Oh, but I have it. Yeah, okay. It is hard to pass. Yeah. It's hard to pass when I have this large thing in my mouth. I go with sesame.
Really?
I'm like preferably a sesame bagel guy. I'll do an everything bagel. I'll do a garlic bagel, but sesame is my shit.
So I nailed it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, I nailed it in the sense that I ordered it, but I actually thought you were in everything.
I could do everything.
I'm doing everything, and I'm doing dill.
I don't know the dill thing.
Really?
Is that weird?
What? You're half Jewish. You're
full.
You're full Jew.
Dude, look at my hair. It's not there
is it
yet.
Is it the God.
That's too much.
Is it the I know food wise, you're really into things like like matzo ball soup.
I love matzo ball soup.
Is that your comfort food when you're sick? Are you?
Yeah, no. That's like. So actually, I got sick recently. I was out on the road and I got sick. And I like hammered my cold with like massive amounts of chicken matzo ball soup and Robitussin and Claritin and Slippery Elm. You know Slippery Elm?
I don't know Slippery Elm. But it sounds like a bad rapper.
Slippery Elm. Slippery Elm is something that Fitz had told ZZ to take when she got sick on tour once.
Oh, wow. And it works?
It knocks your cold right out, combined with other things.
Who were you on the road with?
I went up to see ZZ.
Okay. Do you go on? Does she have a bus?
Mm-hmm.
Wow,
this is gonna be a really interesting interview with all bagels in our mouth.
Sorry for talking with our
sorry
food in our mouth, but
yeah,
it kind of feels like the thing that we should do.
Yeah,
you know what do we do? That's real life.
But yeah, so it knocked it out in like less than 48 hours. Like I just hammered my body with like vitamins and medicine and matzo ball soup.
Wow.
Yeah, and Slippery Elm.
I didn't know that. I mean, my wife is really into homeopathic stuff.
Slippery Elm is that.
Yeah.
It's a combination.
I think it works, but more importantly, it works for our marriage. You know, if I take it, because then she's like,
oh, then
okay.
She's like, yeah, yeah. Because if you try to take like actual medicine, she gets mad at you.
She's not into the actual medicine. I mean, she's not, you know.
The way I look at it, I think it's a blend. I think it's like putting like organic drums with program drums. It's like it's a better sound. It's a better way of of sound. It's a better way of getting better.
Mm-hmm.
You got a little bit of like the doctor recommended stuff and a little bit of the like natural stuff.
Right. That's really funny. I was looking back. I was trying to find our first exchange, like our first email exchange.
Our first email exchange.
Mm-hmm. So I was looking at Gmail. It's like, oh, you know, word before I even went to Gmail.
Mine was APA. I probably had an APA address, right?
Yeah, I think you were at APA and I was at Hotmail. So I had to go to my Hotmail thing and I had to like track down my password to try to figure out how we met. And I found like the first email I found about APA coming to see my band was
from Brett.
It's from I wrote an email saying some APA reps came and saw the band last night. Which is crazy because that's, you know, that's that era where you're so excited when anybody shows up to see your band. Mm-hmm. So that's like that was a big deal. But that was June 1st, 2006. So that has been 9 years, over 9 years.
It's almost our 10-year anniversary.
I know. What do we do? We're doing this.
We'll do a podcast.
That's right. That's that thing. Like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I see myself.
Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Yeah. I see myself in 10 years doing a podcast with you.
Right. I see myself in 10 years talking about the podcast we did 10 years ago.
Sort of, I agree.
You know, that's exactly.
It's like 2026, and we're like, man. Yeah. Do you remember 10 years ago when we did that podcast?
Yeah, that's
what
happened.
Crazy.
In 10 years. I don't know. So it's been 9 years, and you actually said to me. This was, I guess, when did SOS come out?
2006.
So I think that it must have just come out. And you were kind of in this phase of, I'm still going to be a booking agent and show the world that I'm a booking agent who can write a hit song.
I was determined. That was it. That's what I wanted to do.
Isn't that are you the first booking agent who has a number one song?
Maybe. I'm not, I mean, you know, obviously you have people like Matt Galley who like, he didn't write the songs, but he has like a successful record label while being a big booking agent.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
There's, you know, certain people like that. But I think probably on the creative side, yeah. I mean, being a booking agent is inherently the least creative thing you could do.
What does that mean? How is that not creative?
I mean, because other than discovering bands, which I love to do no matter whether I was a booking agent or whatever, after that, it kind of stops because once the band has like a team, mm-hmm. you're the agent. Like, why is anyone listening to you as far as like,
right.
you know, I really think that like sonically you should, or hey, you know, style wise you should, you know, I actually fortunately had this kind of relationship with the bands that I'd signed. The first two bands I'd signed at the agency were Republic.
Right.
One Republic at the time, Republic, and The Outline.
Oh, right.
Which is Ryan Raven from obviously Group Love and Captain Cuts, and Graham Fink, the lead singer of Milo Green.
Wow,
that was their band that was on Capitol. So my two bands were Tedder's band and Ryan and Milo and Graham's band, and I was really involved with them creatively.
Sure,
but as a typical booking agent, there's nothing creative about it. You just decide like, should I route? Should I end in California? Should I start in California? And that's pretty much that's your creative contribution.
The idea that you're sitting there as a booking agent with a number one song, and that was your first song you ever wrote? Isn't that something like that? Like it was your first pop song? You told me that.
Kind of. It was like the...
What is it?
It was like the second or third that I took seriously.
And that's crazy. That's nuts.
So we had put together this... I was at the agency. Okay, so I had come out of this terrible relationship where I had a terrible cocaine problem.
Wow.
And had lost my job.
What year is this?
This is 2004.
Okay.
2004. I broke up with this girl who I actually was secretly married to. We got like secretly married in Las Vegas. I have like the craziest stories of all time. So, but we'll just start.
But I've
there.
Known you for a let's, long time. I didn't know.
Let's
that you've
start
been married.
There.
Yeah, I love this. Okay, see
let's
you
start.
Back.
Let's start there. So,
whoa.
Coming off of this relationship where I was doing A&R for Wally at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. I was managing artists, an artist on DreamWorks named Vicious, a rapper that Michael Goldstone and Jeff Sosno had signed, and I had a up and coming producer from the Bay Area that I was managing. Who I had discovered through a friend of mine and who was producing Vicious's album, a guy by the name of Jonathan Rodham. And I was...
What?
These were my clients. And I... Basically, the girl tried to stab me.
Your wife?
Yeah. A secret wife that no one
yeah,
knew.
Yeah, okay, we'll call you
no
secret
one,
wife.
No, secret
it
wife.
It sort of sounds like you're
secret
like
wife. Secret wife tried to stab me.
An FLDS compound.
Yeah. Secret wife tried to stab me. And... I basically had lost my job at Warner Brothers. JR, you know, I couldn't manage anymore. I was just completely, like, caught up in this drug lifestyle scene of L.A. I, like, bought into my own hype. Like, all this crazy, crazy shit. I was just an awful, entitled asshole, right?
Wow.
So,
how old were you at that point?
Like, it was last year. No.
yeah, right.
20, oh, God, how old was I? 26?
Okay,
yeah,
that's the right age to have an ego
yeah.
problem.
It was like a quarter. It was like a quarter life crisis,
right?
Basically,
exactly,
right?
Yeah,
And I basically copped to my parents that I had gotten married in Vegas, and this girl tried to stab me, and I like moved home, and I like, and like Vicious got dropped from DreamWorks, and Wally let me go, and JR, you know, I had given JR to Zach because I didn't know what to do, and Zach had just had stopped being a lawyer and become a manager. Zach was my lawyer.
So you introduced JR and Zach?
Yeah, Zach was my lawyer, and I managed JR. Wow. And then and here's the weird thing, right? So Zach was my lawyer. I managed JR. Zach and I managed JR. Zach managed JR. Zach and JR signed me.
So are, right? are you part of Beluga Heights?
I was the first person signed to Beluga Heights.
But you're not like a...
Not anymore. So when my Sony deal ended, my deal with Beluga
Heights. No, I mean like you're not a partner of Beluga Heights.
No. I was never a partner. That was a separate thing. They signed me to Beluga Heights. I was their writer. Wow. So it was like weird. It's like a weird full circle. But so I had nothing and I was broke. And I moved home, and I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I was burnt out at 26.
Wow.
And I spent the summer working part-time at a lighting store on La Brea and Melrose.
Like a house lighting store?
Yeah, they made like custom lamps, and like they do a lot of like custom shades and lamps for movies.
What were you feeling emotionally at that point?
I was still just, I don't know, honestly.
Were you still on drugs?
Yeah, I was still doing a lot of coke and drinking a lot and
going to work all fucked up.
Yeah,
wow,
a little bit of that.
Did you even were you into music at all at that point?
Yeah, I was just
like, were you listening to music at that point, or were you sort of like, I don't care anymore about anything?
And also, I was listening to mostly hip hop at the time, like no pop music, no rock music, nothing, no dance music for sure. Dance music wasn't even like a fashion yet, but. Yeah, man, it was a crazy time. But, my dad was like, you got to get a job. My stepdad. So I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know where to go. And he's like, my like second cousin owns like a lighting store. You should go work there part time. So I did that. And then he kept saying like, you got to get like a real job though. Like, so on the days you're not working,
you have to get a career.
Yeah. Figure out what you're going to do.
But he's saying who's all messed up on drugs.
He doesn't know I'm messed up on drugs.
Oh, but they know you're secretly married.
Now at this point, in the middle of divorcing or getting that annulled or whatever, right? So
can you say your secret wife's? No, I don't need to know.
You don't trust me. You don't want that because if she hears this, you don't know she's.
Wow,
she's
so fine.
She's a wonderful person. She's a wonderful person. We all love her and wish her the best.
Right? Is she messed up on drugs too?
She's a wonderful person, and we all love her and wish her the best.
Wow. Okay, so you go and you do it. This is crazy. So you go, you're working at a lighting store. Your dad says your stepdad says you should go and do
right. So
get
I,
a job.
So
or
I,
a career.
I of course, because I'm 26 and I know everything, and I've at this point, you know, A&R'd an Eminem album, a Tupac album, and I have had artists signed, and I've had artists that I managed that were nominated for Grammys, and I obviously think I'm the biggest hot shit in the world who's unemployed and living at home with his parents and broke. Still in this sense of entitlement, like, you know, I'm also at the, you know, where it all started obviously was working at Interscope when I was 18 as Neil Bogart's son and like feeling like the world owed me something, right? And then, you know, I basically decided I couldn't go work for a record label. I couldn't start at the beginning again. I couldn't go back to the mailroom. Too much pride, right? So I'm not going to go to a label. I'm not going to go to a publishing company. I can't go to do management. Like, what do I do?
And you already have like when you're – it's not a bad thing when you're let go by a record label. We know 50 people who've been let go by a record label who then got promoted at their next job just because the industry doesn't know anything. But when you're let go by Tom Wally at this point, did everyone know about your drug problem? Is that
no,
sort
dude,
of
I was
like
getting,
why
I was getting
you're
a,
getting
I was
fired?
Getting,
or
I was getting
you...
a check and I wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think I brought him one band in like 15 months.
Right. Right.
I think it was just based on the fact that I brought him stuff when I worked at Interscope for him. Because I, you know, he was my first boss at Interscope. He pulled me out of the mailroom and gave me my first A&R job and everything. And he, you know, taught me how to make a record with Tupac. And, he knew I brought in Eminem. And he knew, you know, I brought him a bunch of other artists that got signed other places. And I was involved in their A&R team over there for him. So when he went to Warner Brothers, you know, they brought me on in that capacity of more of like a A&R scout-ish A&R type. Not someone who'd make a record.
Right.
I wasn't coming from a creative place.
No, it was
someone who had a really good ear and eye for talent.
Right.
Who would find him the next bands. And I think like 15 months in, I hadn't brought him any, like not even like, hey, check this out.
So by 26, you've already then, when you say you A&R'd, going back one step, When you say you A&R'd Eminem and
the first album,
all that, so you're on the Marshall Mathers
Slim Shady LP,
the Slim Shady LP, and how many A&R people are on that?
Five.
Wow. What does that mean? You
one,
A&R'd
one is that? One is the wife of the owner of the company, and two are DJ Mormilli and right. and Dean Geislinger.
And then, and what does that mean? You A&R'd it, like you were helping coordinate sessions, or you were helping find songs and beats, and like, what is it? What do you? What is it?
We all just hung out at the studio and made music. It was I was there for like the making of the entire album, and you know I did. I brought in the song "As the World Turns" was a song I brought in track wise. Uh-huh.
And at this point, you're probably, you know, early 20s.
I was 18 years old, 19 years old, yeah.
So messed up. And that's because we would go to
like Tijuana to get like pills at like the Farmacia.
So all of you guys were messed up on that because you're having fun.
I was actually sober during the Eminem album, which is
ironic. Because you were so young or what?
Well, I had come back from rehab and in high school. And started
okay, so let's go back because like we can
flashback.
Okay, this is the weirdest way of telling a story.
I'll catch you up.
Okay,
you guys should probably just edit it. You know, you could keep it like more of like an all that jazz kind of thing.
This is the flashback. Memento. This is Memento.
So when I was 16, I was interning at Interscope mm-hmm. for Tom Wally and Steve Berman, and when I was 17, I got sent to rehab.
Right.
And when I was 18, I graduated high school in Oregon in rehab. And then I came back when I was 18 and I started working right away in the mailroom at Interscope. Mm-hmm. I still kept in touch with everyone at Interscope and I was friends with everyone there. When I was 16 and I was interning, I was Tom's intern and DJ was his uncle's intern, Jimmy's intern.
Right.
So DJ and I became really good friends.
Right.
And have actually been playing fantasy like sports with each other literally since then. So it's been like 21 years.
Right.
We've been in fantasy leagues together, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, we'll get into that. That I know a lot about.
When I was 18, I worked in the mailroom there. And then, you know, right after Tupac, I was there, you know, I was there like the day Tupac died. Like I have like vivid memories of like people like crying and like the whole place was just like the saddest thing ever.
Sure.
But when I was in high school and interning there, Death Row was actually in the building, Interscope building. It was in Westwood.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I was like the kid who would get off the elevator and like, you know, smoke weed with like Danny Boy or Rage or like, you know, and like, go like stuff mailers and shit, you know, that kind of stuff, right? When I was 18, I was in the mailroom, and about 3 or 4 months after being in the mailroom, they needed to make a Tupac record. And there was no one left there who knew anything about hip hop. I mean, Death Row was gone, obviously. They were split from from Interscope, and they were going back into the Interscope owned masters and figuring out how to like make a new record. So Tom figured this was like the kid who he knew was like a hip hop head.
Right.
It was just like the perfect play to teach me how to make a record. So he pulled me out of the mailroom into A&R and was like, you're going to be the coordinator for this. You're going to run, you know.
Did you, at that point, are you, I know that you were also a rapper-ish. Mm-hmm. So then at that point, are you trying to get a record deal?
I'd already tried. I gave in already.
Oh, at that point you were like, I'm retiring. I'm putting, you know, hanging my...
I tried right when I got back from rehab from Oregon,
uh-huh.
and no one wanted to sign me. I went to New York and shot my own demo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So then at that point,
didn't work.
Crazy. So are you still, at that point, you're not writing anymore though?
No. I mean, no, because I'm like, well, maybe I'm just supposed to be in the business like my dad.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm creative by nature, but maybe I'm not supposed to be an artist.
How old were you when your dad passed away?
4.
So then...
And now you're really flashing. We're going flashing.
I know. Back
to your 4.
The legacy of both your dad and your mom is obviously in the industry,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Is that something...
She managed
Right. Kiss. She managed Kiss. Yeah. And, you know, both, you grew up around a different era of music. You grew up around, you know, face makeup. And all that.
Yeah,
and then,
sure.
You know, and you end up in this street, most street kind of music. I mean, but on the same level.
Kind of my dad did too. You know, I mean, you know, he was instrumental in signing Curtis Mayfield and Bill Withers and a lot of that stuff to Buddha Records before he ran Casablanca. And then obviously Parliament and Chocolate City. And, you know, he was always.
When you were saying that, do you think that Tom Wally and these people were giving you an advantage because of that? Or do you think that because you grew up around music, you were more qualified?
No, I think it had to do strictly the fact that like he needed someone to go in and like transcribe 120 Tupac songs.
Wow.
And actually have an opinion about hip hop.
Yeah, not just be a guy in the room that's just another friend.
Right.
Is it?
So it was kind of like way of putting it. It was kind of like this is a Fanny Shakur. This is like Mo Preem, right. Tupac's brother. These are the Outlaws.
Sure.
Like, go make a record.
So crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously, like, the first 6 months, I transcribed every Tupac song ever written, which I have to give credit to as it couldn't have made me worse, but it's probably contributed to me being a better lyricist now.
Wow. Yeah, I bet.
You know?
Yeah.
Like
the rhyme schemes are insane. I mean, amazing. The timing's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, I went to this vault. We pulled up every 2-inch reel of every song. We had to put together, like, these rough mixes. And then I had to put them onto DAT. Most people don't know what that is.
Yeah, no, that was
there used to be these
sure.
small the tapes thing. Called yeah. DATs.
Right? Yeah, that's what I recorded my first album on.
So DAT, so we had to put them down to DAT based on, like, whether I thought they were an A-level song, a B-level song, or a C-level song.
Wow.
It was my first creative decision ever.
Wait, so throughout his career, after Tupac died and they released later, you know, the stuff after he died, is it... How many of those records were ones that you worked on? All of them. Because it was all those C-sides.
I'd heard all of them.
Wow.
But the I just didn't want to swallow.
I love that we're eating bagels.
I know. I turned my head to swallow.
And talking about cocaine at 11 in the morning.
Bagels, cocaine, and Tupac, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be my autobiography.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the A songs, some of the B songs, and some of the C songs made the first album. It was actually a double album. It was called Are You Still Down, Remember Me.
Right.
And because of a deal that Jimmy had made with Jive for some reason, came out as an Interscope Jive co-release, which was really weird. Because
Tupac
Jive
was on Jive?
Just for this album.
Oh, wow.
So it was like an Interscope Jive co-release. Jive was through Zomba, right, which was BMG. It wasn't Sony, obviously. I mean, nowadays you could Jive and Interscope could never do anything because it's like the Crips and Bloods collaborating, right? But like... the A&Rs on the project were, you know, on our side, on the Interscope side. The Jive wasn't really involved at all. But the A&Rs that are listed on the project are like Jeff Fenster and John McHugh. So it's
no way.
My first time ever meeting Fenster, working with Fenster, was on that project.
Wow.
Yeah.
I once said to Fenster that my first CD that I ever bought was Fushnikins featuring Shaquille O'Neal.
Amazing.
And he goes, I A&R'd that.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Hell yeah, man.
Jeff Fenster, not only from having an incredible pop ear now, is like a legendary hip-hop A&R.
Yeah. And he's super pro. I mean, there are very few, you know, A&R guys that are actual A&R guys. He's a professional A&R guy.
Like, I know the captain brought in Tribe Called Quest, but Fenster made those records.
Yeah. Crazy.
Like, dude, you made Tribe records, bro.
Yeah.
Dude, there's a rapper named Ari the Rugged Man.
Okay.
You know that guy? He was signed to Jive. He actually hated his experience there. He has a song where in the middle of the song, after the album he put out after he left Jive Records, in the middle of the song, he says, like, dreaming about killing Jeff Fenster. Like, in the song.
Whoa.
it's crazy.
So dark. wait, okay, so anyway, obviously...
I'm at Interscope, I worked there for a while, and then while I was working on the Tupac project, I went to a freestyle contest in Inglewood.
For real?
Yeah.
How did that go?
I saw this white kid destroy everybody. Saying things like, don't make my facial tissue a racial issue and stuff, like all these like really creative internal rhymes. And I grabbed his demo and brought it in and screamed at the top of my lungs for 5 months. No one would listen to me.
So who introduced him to Dre?
Total by accident. He heard the tape got slipped to Jimmy. While M was in town, we were hanging out with M. We were up at the radio station. We had Friday Night Flavors. The next night we were at the Wake Up Show, which were... radio shows that were on Power 106 and a defunct radio station called The Beat. I guess, is The Beat still around? I don't know. They used to have like rappers on at midnight and they would like battle and like talk about underground shit. Dre heard the demo that same weekend. M happened to be in town and Monday they met. They came into Interscope and he was signed.
Just made it happen.
That was it.
Did Eminem ever hear you rap?
Yeah, for sure.
Really?
Yeah, of course. In fact, the song As the World Turns on his first album, the way I say, like, I brought that track in is that track was originally a track from my demo.
No.
Yep.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Do you have the demo version?
Not with me, but yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he obviously killed it way better than me.
Right, but I mean, he just rewrote verses.
He's like, are you gonna do things? I was like, nah, man, I'm done rapping. He's like, can I have this track? I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah,
sure, Marshall. Did you call him Marshall?
M.
So he was always M&M.
For me, like the Bass Brothers and everybody around us would call him Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Wow, when was the last time you saw him?
Oh, forever.
Yeah, so it's not like you guys kept in touch.
No.
So, okay.
Obviously, I wish.
Right.
You know, I saw him several times. I mean, you know, like my mom always jokes. She's like, you know, she always tells people, like, Eminem used to be at our house. She would call me mom, and he came over for Thanksgiving. Like, you know, it was that. He was like the homie.
So weird. So wait, okay. So obviously, there's this huge A&R thing. We're going to fast forward to.
Yeah, anyway, should I go? I go through Interscope. I leave. I go into management. Blah, 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 blah.
You said you were sober during the Eminem thing, and then when did you relapse?
When I met this girl.
Oh.
Thus tying the whole story together.
Wow. And when
did you meet? This wonderful, wonderful person.
Right. When did you meet this beautiful
2002.
Yeah.
So
then all the way to 2006, you're 2004, you're having some sort of spiral.
Really quick spiral, just jumping off a cliff.
Was that like that wasn't an option for you though? You weren't actually thinking in a literal sense.
Oh, no.
You were
no,
never
no.
like
I'm
suicidal
too,
with
I'm
it.
I'm too chicken shit to kill myself.
Right, of course. Yeah, I would have said.
I wouldn't even put needles in me. Like, I don't know, whatever. Like, I'm not a pain fan.
Sure.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow. So then 2004, I'm getting divorced.
Throwing my entire life away.
Yeah.
Falling down into this spiral drug hole. She tries to stab me. Right. I'm working at the lighting store.
Sure.
Fast forwarding to everything we said. And I decide that I can't go back to a label.
At this point,
can't go to a publisher. I can't go to a manager.
Right. And JR and Zach have already started Beluga Heights while you were in the lighting store?
Yes. It was called it was called Net Worth Entertainment. It wasn't called Beluga Heights yet. And, you know, I didn't know. I really just didn't know what I was going to do. So I tried to figure out. I was either going to go work in radio because no one knew me there, or I was going to go work at an agency because no one knew me there.
Right.
That was my rationalization. Like, if I'm going to start from the beginning, I'm going to go.
And labels were not having it at this point. Or
just,
you didn't want to go.
I didn't
want to
go because I just didn't want to come back in as, like, I'll be an assistant again. Like, I felt like that was.
Too much pride at that point.
Yeah, dude. Stupid, but understandable for my age and the position I was in.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sober yet.
Credits. Okay.
So I went and met with a ton of people. Is the turkey up? Yeah. The turkey's ready.
Yeah.
Mom, the meatloaf.
When's your stovetop stuffing?
So I went to a bunch of meetings and actually Ben Gordon, you know Ben?
Yeah.
He was A&R at Interscope.
Yeah.
So Ben introduced me to this guy, Josh Humiston.
Okay, right. Uh-huh.
And said Josh is looking for an assistant at an agency. So I went to Josh and
what's that? Sorry. So you went to Josh Humiston.
I went to Josh and I basically like begged him to hire me. And he was like, you're way too qualified to be my assistant. Are you going to do bitch work? I said, promise, I'll be your bitch. I promise. I'll find you bands. I'm really good at that.
Right.
You teach me how to be an agent.
Okay.
I know nothing about being an agent.
Sure.
You think I'm overqualified, but not in this world. I know nothing. All right. So All you right. teach me how to be a booking agent, and I'll find you bands.
Yeah.
So, you know, about a month into it, you know, being his assistant, I found the outline.
Right.
And about 2 months into it, Brett was like, my buddy is in town from Denver and you gotta listen to this song. It was Apologize. I was like, that song is amazing. He's like, let's go see him. We went to the show at the Roxy and like,
yeah.
I was like
15 people
coked out of my mind.
Wow.
He played this song called like Put Your Hands Up or Hands in the Air. I forget what the song was. Yeah. It was a great One Republic song.
Yeah.
I think it ended up being a Hillary Duff song at one point. But, literally the first song of the show, like they hit the first chorus and I looked at Brett and I was like, we're signing them. I was like so coked out.
Yeah.
Like, we're signing them, man. This is amazing. I was like, I'll be right back. I'm going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, it was like,
right.
And so came back into obviously APA the next day and was like, you guys, you have to sign this band. This
Did Brett work for you or you guys?
Brett was Craig Newman's assistant and I was Josh's assistant, but I also was able to sign stuff.
Right.
So technically because Brett had brought it in, Craig first got One Republic.
Sure.
I then shopped their deal and got them signed to Velvet Hammer Columbia, their first deal.
Right.
And so like this is before everybody, they got, everybody passed. Right. Velvet, Dave Abino at Velvet Hammer signed them.
So, but they had a manager, didn't they?
At the time, it was Marcus Spence.
Oh, right. Wait, Marcus Spence was their manager?
Yeah. And he had met Ryan because Ryan used to be signed to Timberland to Beat Club as a writer ghost producer. And he worked on like Bubba Sparks and stuff.
Right.
In fact, I had met Ryan 2 years earlier playing ping pong at the Hit Factory in Miami.
But did he remember that?
No, we walked in and I was like, dude, I know you. And he's like, yeah, Hit Factory, right? I'm like, yeah. Like, it was crazy. Yeah. 2 years earlier, we had spent a whole night like hanging out. Right. One of my artists was in with Scott Storch. Ryan was in with Timberland.
Oh, no.
And we played ping pong together.
And that's definitely where you had your, where the drugs were out of hand. I mean, with Scott Storch on.
Yeah, but I was on like massive amounts of E. I was in Miami, dude. What do you, you know?
Sure, sure.
And I was with the wonderful woman. The wonderful
right,
girl
yeah,
was
she's
with
so
me.
Sweet.
And she was also on E.
Yeah.
And it was a good time. But yeah, so anyway, so Ryan and I are like, oh, we know each other, whatever. So Craig signed it. Once I made agent, because I took One Republic became mine.
Right.
And then once I left, Brett became agent. One Republic was his.
Right. I mean, and then
– And Brett and Ryan, then, Brett and Ryan went together.
Is that when I came in?
Like, yeah.
So you were gone at that point or I was – and I don't know exactly.
Brett was already working with you before he was like a full agent.
Right.
He was like a junior agent.
Yeah. I mean, that was what was so crazy. I tell this story. You know, I remember emailing some friends over at USC because I went to USC. And this was 2006 or whatever. I said, if you guys are here, you should see – you know, Glacier Hiking, my old band, and One Republic are playing. I promise you guys, they're going to be huge. And there were maybe, I don't know, 7 people who saw them play and saw me play.
Well, Ryan was on your record.
Yeah, Ryan sang the feature on Save Some, one of the Glacier Hiking songs. It's so bizarre to watch any of your friends go from, I mean, I have this conversation.
Do you remember when we went to the wedding in Oklahoma?
Yeah, that's another story. We'll get to that in a second. But the idea that you go from, I say this, where people are as successful as the day you meet them, it's hard to adjust your head that, oh yeah, Ryan's, you know, one of the biggest songwriters in the world, and you meet him when he's, you know, when you're playing shows in front of 16 people. It's hard to adjust
also,
your mind.
Also, him writing and producing for other people at the time, but incredibly frustrated about it.
What do you mean?
You know, I mean, he had written the first single I remember him having out as a writer, since when I knew him, as a writer producer was Nikki Flores,
right?
She was signed to Epic Records, right. And he had a single with her called "Strike While the Iron's Hot" or whatever it was. It didn't go,
sure,
obviously, but like that was frustrating for him, you know, or like J Lo, "Do It Well."
Oh, I never heard of it.
It was a single for her. Super frustrating. I mean, like you know, it was his.
It was his.
It was
dirty
his
answer.
Learning experience. I mean, he and I had a.
Just kidding.
Basically, the only song in existence of me, JR, and Ryan was an Ashley Tisdale single called "He Said, She Said."
Oh wow! Wow.
JR did the track. I mean, Ryan did the top line.
So when did you start? When did you switch over to write with Ryan and JR? When were you like, I'm done being
an agent? So I'm at the agency, and if you ever want to accelerate an addiction. A drug addiction, go work at an agency because everyone's fucked up And
really?
I went from like...
I don't know this. I mean, I've had agents...
Agents party, and
UTA and APA.
And they're all like super functional. Like that's like...
Right, that's
like, I feel
problem.
Like if they stopped doing drugs, they'd be bad agents.
Right.
It's the opposite. Like wow. They're like fueled.
And you think that's still prevalent?
I think that in the industry, there's a lot of people who are still doing a lot of drugs or drinking, and there's a lot of people who are sober. And the minority are the people who are neither.
Right. Yeah.
Agencies sure. included.
Right.
Probably more so, actually, agencies.
Right.
So
you go over to JR and you're like, hey.
So six months into it, I go to a doctor, and he's like, you have a hole in your septum. Like, you burned a hole through your septum.
That's sweet.
And like it's whistling.
And this is.
And like,
yeah, you can probably sample that now.
I'm like, well, I'm not going to do coke anymore.
Right.
But I'm still going to drink and do like in like pills and weed and stuff.
You're divorced at this point.
I haven't even. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm divorced from the first one. Yeah. I actually at this point have started dating my second wife.
Okay. We'll get into that.
Right. She doesn't know that obviously I have a problem at this point, you know, at this point.
Oh.
And I go to New Year's, Jordy is like, he's like, come to Vegas for New Year's. Maroon 5's playing, you know,
right.
Come party with us all week.
Right.
So I went to Vegas and
Jordan,
you know,
Feldstein.
Yeah. I went to Vegas and like, you know, hanging out with Adam and all them who I grew up with,
right.
You know, since we were kids, and you know, everything's like comped and we're all like doing shots, and you know, Adam's like betting like $30,000 a hand at like the tables at the Aladdin, and it's like fun,
right.
So fun. And I was up for like 3 days, and this guy gave me an upper, and then this 6 hours later, this guy gave me a downer, and then I woke up, and this guy's giving me an upper, and I'm drinking.
Yeah.
And it was like crazy weekend,
yeah.
And I was just, it killed me. Like, I came home that weekend on January 3rd, and I've been sober ever since. Like,
wow,
I was like,
you
just
never went to meetings or anything. You just
a week later, I started going to meetings.
Okay.
So I came home, and I was just like, I'm tired, man. I don't want to do this anymore. I can't do this anymore.
And at this point, did you tell your second wife?
Not yet, but I went to my stepdad, and who is a doctor and who's also sober, and he was like, you should go to meetings. It took me about a week to actually go to my first meeting, and then I was pretty hardcore AA.
Right.
And then, of course, I came clean to the girl I was dating, and then came clean to people around me, and, you know, stayed away, didn't hang out with the agents, you know, didn't,
right.
Like, really, like, kind of just started, just changed my life, and
right.
In the process of it, had my ambition was back. Like, I was hungry. Like,
yeah.
Really, I was like, I'm gonna show everybody
yeah.
that I'm me. Like, forget, like, you know, fuck everyone, man. This is it.
Sure.
You know, like, I'm gonna. This is my comeback.
Yeah.
So, in my grand plan of my comeback, I decide I'm gonna put together a multiracial TLC.
Okay.
And I'm going to get writers. And get writers to write to tracks from JR. I'm going to cut JR in. So I went to JR and Zach. I'm like, you got to give me all the tracks that people aren't buying.
Right.
So give me the tracks. We go out and, you know, JR helps find writers and whatever. But at this point, he's like, his only success has been like, you know, like the Best Friend remix for 50 Cent and like
right.
a Little Kim song that like peaked at like 30 or
sure.
something, Lighters or something,
yeah.
whatever it was, or Whoa, or I forget what it was called. But so he's like, you know, he's in playing keys for Dre. Like he's
yeah.
like up and Zach's still building JR at this point.
Yeah.
He's JR, is not JR.
Right.
And then also, you know, my client / friend Ryan is also giving me songs and ideas for the girls. So I went out and put this girl group together. And I took I was living at home still.
Right.
I took the little money I was making, like $400 a week from the agency, spent it on studio time
right.
for the girls, and put together this girl group. And I tried to
get it signed.
Yeah.
Wait, how is it? It's crazy to think that.
While I was an assistant at the agency, basically.
It's weird to think that Neil Bogart and, you know, his son is spent needing to search for, use like the little money that you're making in a week to find studio time. I feel like the city probably would have studio space for you. Were you at this point
no.
trying to be like, I'm doing my own thing?
Here's a crazy thing. So my dad being who my dad was, people
yeah.
assumed that people gave me things. But because my dad passed away when I was 4, his friends in the industry would always want to talk about him, but
right.
they never wanted to give anything for it. It was all of the assumption of nepotism and none of the benefits.
Wow.
My entire life.
Yeah.
I never got one thing because of who my dad was.
Right.
And to a certain point, at a certain point in my life, 18 to 26, basically, 28-ish, assumed and felt entitled to it.
Right. There's a, I mean, there's that huge difference of deserving and earning, you know, and you, when you feel like you deserve it, nothing happens.
Right.
But when you feel like you've earned it,
right,
things happen.
Yeah.
For sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't think anything's really easy as ever. Nothing's ever really come easy in that way for me.
Right.
I always feel like, oh, this is going to be the easy thing for me. This is like, oh, this is the time when I get my luck rolls my way. I've always had to work really hard for everything.
Yeah.
And I just, at this point, I just accept I'm going to. I don't ever think about like, well, maybe it'll just be this easy this time. No, it's always rolling a ball up a hill.
Wow.
It's fine.
So when you get, at this point, speaking of rolling a ball uphill, you're developing a multiracial girl group, which is probably like, talk about rolling up a ball up a hill.
No, I was insane. But like, this was like my big, like,
I'm back.
When I think of ideas, I try to think of like bit larger than life. Not let's find one artist who can sing with a great song. Right. This was like, I'm thinking world arenas and like, you know, this is like the biggest thing ever. I got to find their waterfalls. Like, you got to do that, you know? So there's like this Israeli rapper.
Right.
And this black girl singer and this white girl singer.
Right.
And all of their songs are being, you know, 90% produced by an unknown J.R. Rodham and like 10% produced by an unknown Ryan Tedder.
Right.
And about 40 songs in, Zach is like, dude, we can't shop this group, man. We need hits. Like, these are all really good songs, but like, if we don't have a hit, like, we're dead in the water, man.
Right.
Like, and JR and Zach had this crazy idea. They're like, why don't you try writing to some of the tracks? Like, you know, you write for fun. Like, I've been joking around. I'll write on stuff, like, mess around and stuff, you know? They're like, you're like so talented. You're so creative. Like, why don't you write something?
And then all of a sudden, so soft sell.
I went home and I listened. JR gave me all his reject beats that he wasn't selling.
Wow.
And I listened to all the beats, and the first song I wrote was to this one beat called Jungleistic.
Right. That didn't work out, did it? Especially for a multiracial group, huh?
No.
You think maybe that was a bad title?
No. No, it was like
still shopping.
It was like let sweat get wet, get jungleistic, dun 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 dun, ballistic.
You know,
it was and by the way, like, the fact that I even knew melody was like a surprise to me.
Yeah.
Like, I surprised myself that when I went to sing, like, I wasn't singing, like, you know, sometimes you get, they're like, no, you could sing melody, and people just sing to the chords and you're like, oh, they don't hear it.
Right.
Like, the fact that I could hear it was a surprise to me, but I loved it. And I was, as a rapper, everything I wrote was like a rapper, right? So it was all internal rhyme schemes and like super clever lines that you'd never work in pop music. Then I wrote another song, was terrible. And then the third song I wrote, so the second song that we ended up keeping was over a thrown away beat sampling Tainted Love by Soft Cell.
Wow.
And I went and played them for Zach and Jer, and they're like, dude, you wrote those all by yourself? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, I mean, yeah, like, that's incredible. Cut them on the girls. Let's go shop them.
Right.
Like, they were like that excited about them. And even SOS has written like a rap song. I mean, like, it, even just right away, it's just all internal rhymes. And like, it's, you know, it was originally called Rescue You, and then like something else in like parentheses. I forget what it was. SOS wasn't even the title at all. That's not what I called it. It was like Rescue You, Losing It.
But those are those lyrics. You just changed the title.
Jay Brown changed the title.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So we go to shop the group. JR and Zach go to New York. They do showcases in LA. The girls are terrible in the room. They just completely choke in every meeting.
Right.
No one wants to sign the group. Everybody wants to buy the songs.
Interesting. So even the labels they're savvy enough at this point.
Yeah, the labels, almost every label said the same thing, which is like, yeah, but we have these girl groups that are already signed. Like, we could use the songs. I'm just not sure about the group.
Right.
And JR and Zach eventually called me and were like, good news, bad news. I'm like, what? And they're like, the bad news is you got to drop the girl group. I'm like, what? This is my comeback. What are you talking about? This is the worst news in the world. That's not even bad news. That's
$400.
Like $400. Worst news. But good news is we sold the songs.
Okay.
What do you mean you sold the songs? They're my girl group songs.
Yeah. So upset. You're so upset.
So pissed. Trust me, you're sitting there being like,
I should go and go
like
drink.
6 months sober.
Yeah.
Trust me, Evan. This is going to be better. This is going to be better. Trust me. And
they were right.
Yeah. Well, at first, Christina Milian was cutting SOS.
Oh, interesting.
And then she turned it down.
Yeah.
And then it was like sat there for a few months, like, okay, I guess nothing's going to happen with the song. And then it was like, Jay wants to cut it on this new chick they have, this girl Rihanna. And then they sent us the song of her singing it. And I was like,
perfect.
I was like, this is terrible.
Really?
Yeah, because you take for granted the fact that you know her accent now.
Oh, right. That's right.
But at the time, you were like, what the hell is this accent?
Right.
This is terrible. She kind of sounds like there's something wrong with her, like mentally. Like, it was a little off. Like, you were like literally confused by the way she was pronouncing words. You were like, what? How would that ever work on pop radio today?
Right.
You know? And then listening back to the original demo now,
yeah,
it's so vanilla. Because she's had so much personality and her voice is what made it.
Her tone, I mean, that thing of tone is worth more than skill.
Yeah.
And her tone is so unique
and she was 17.
That accent's actually an advantage.
She was just growing into it. She didn't even know what she had yet.
Yeah, she had Pawned Down to Replay, and then SOS is like her first real number one, pop hit.
Yeah. They shot the video for SOS on her 18th birthday.
Wow.
On her. We were there at the video shoot. It was on her. It was her birthday that day.
That's crazy. And at this point, you're thinking, oh, that's cool, but at that point, she's a mid-level artist.
Well, the song came out in January 2006.
Uh-huh.
In May 2006, the same day I got made full agent at APA, the song went number one in 15 countries.
Wow.
So when you say, going back to
you, it took 5 months for it to go number one.
Yeah. Long story short, by the way, it was the first time ever that they held back a single on iTunes. And the song was flying up the charts, and it was brilliant.
Why were they holding it back? What is it?
It was number 30, 33, number 32, number 32, number 32.
Yeah, right.
Dropped the single on iTunes, won.
Wow.
It was the first time I ever saw that. I'd never seen any. If someone can tell
me.
You
say number one at radio, number one on Billboard too?
Yeah,
is that the whole thing?
Number one on both. Yeah. It was number one on radio, and they hadn't even released it on iTunes yet. Like,
that's,
it wasn't out
so
yet.
Nuts.
So when they dropped it, it shot to number one.
Right.
Because of the sales.
Right.
And
was that Jay's idea? Was that like a manager move?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. It was genius at the time, and no one had ever done it. Obviously, nowadays people drop songs before they even go to radio and they go to number one. Mm-hmm. But back then, radio led. So going back to your original comment 6 years ago, or it feels like 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I was an agent.
When the bagels were fresh.
And I didn't want to leave being a songwriter either. I wanted to do both because I got made agent the same day that the song went number one.
Right, and you had aspirations. At that point, you probably think I could run, be a big agent. And,
right.
I can write songs on the side.
That's what it was. And then JR and Zach called me like every day, dude, you got to leave the agency. Dude, you got to leave the agency. What are you doing? And I would come.
Why? Is that a mistake?
Yeah. I tell people all the time.
And why is it a mistake?
Because now we actually know when – we can actually sense when one of our songs is reacting, right?
Yeah.
So what do we do when we know a song is going to go?
We write like crazy.
Like crazy.
Right.
Because you know that the nature of this industry is that when you have a hit song, everybody wants to know what else do you have.
Right.
Right? So I didn't know that at that time. Not only did I not write like crazy prior to the song going out, I wrote part-time for the 4 months post the song being number one.
Sure.
Which is, like, insane.
That's so crazy.
Like, in retrospect, you would never do that. You'd be like, oh, song went number one. Okay, peace. I'm going to go do another job.
Yeah, like, that's like, so crazy.
Like, no, you capitalize on that. Even if you hadn't written prior to that, you go crazy, right? You just double sessions every day. Like, what do I got, you know?
And
it was frustrating for JR because his writer had a day job.
Well, at that point, it's probably not really a money issue. It's just a focus issue.
No, of course, it's total focus issue.
And
also, JR was doing like 20-hour days too. Like, so I knew I could do night sessions with him. You know, he was like on this like insane.
Because he was
7 days a week, 20 hours a day.
Because he was capitalizing on it. He knew better.
Yeah.
And he had a manager that was pushing that.
Pushing, yeah. I probably pushing him to work less, but JR just wouldn't hear that.
Right.
You know, he was just. So, in the meantime, eventually JR, they called me and they were like, what's it going to take, bro? What's it going to take for you to leave the agency? And so I said, I thought of the craziest thing I could think of at the time, which was like, I don't know, put me in the studio with Britney Spears.
Right.
And the next week, me and JR spent the entire week in Vegas with Britney Spears. She was a huge fan of SOS. And
crazy. And you were like, okay.
And I came back and I quit the agency.
Sure.
And I kept my word. I quit the agency. I went to go write full time.
And here's like, you know, One Republican, Glacier Hiking, and, you know, what's the Ryan's band from Captain Cuts?
Oh, The Outline.
The Outline. So these three bands are sort of just now floating around.
Ryan and I never talked about it. Obviously, we became really good friends and whatnot. And my second wife and his wife are like still really good friends. Yeah. And I never thought, like, I always thought in like retrospect, like what it must have been like for being as talented as you are as Ryan.
Yeah.
And your agent.
Leaves.
Hit, no, oh, had hits a number one. Before yeah. you have a hit song.
Yeah.
It must be like a really weird and surreal, sure. frustrating moment.
Yeah.
You know.
It's frustrating. I mean, this is.
But like.
I mentioned this in the last time I would have been hung out, but like envy is really hard in this industry. I wake up in a really good mood and then I go and I check charts.
Why?
Because
that's the first thing you do?
No, I'm lying in bed. I have three songs on a chart right now.
Don't do it, man. Don't do it.
So I'm like watching these charts, but the reality is that there's already songs that I see climbing up in front of, and there are new songs that get released every week, and all of a sudden I'm still lying in bed with one eye open, checking my phone in a shitty mood because my song's not climbing fast enough and all this, and it's, you know, I think. The closer you are with your friends being successful, the more excited you are that your friends are successful, and the more envious you are that you're, you know, when you how close you are, because the proximity gets closer and closer.
Do you have people that are you're happy for, and then there are people you're not happy for?
Yeah, everyone does, right?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, I try to be happy, man. I just try.
But there are the people. There are the people who. There are some people where I don't think they're particularly talented, and they're fortunate for being in the room at the right time over and over again, which means that they must have that vibe.
No,
that's
dude,
just but magic.
90% of whatever 90% of you know this, dude. 90% of every session is you in the room.
I know.
10% is talent.
That's probably right.
It's the energy, man. That's what you bring. It's, you know.
Yeah.
It's like.
I always say that it lives and dies by you. You're a primary writer if you're in the room.
If you're an asshole in the room, no one wants to write with you, yeah. And you probably bring down the room.
Right.
You know, there's got to be every successful writer out there has to contribute something to the being in the room, I think. Although I will say there are a few successful writers I've written with who are just, it's a pain to write with them.
Right.
But they're constantly successful.
Right.
So maybe there's something to say.
So do you look at their success and do you get frustrated?
No.
Or do you look at it and you're just not even affected by it?
I'm not even affected by it. I don't care.
Do you think it's because of the number ones that you've had that you're able to see it from that perspective, or do you think it doesn't matter?
No, I think if you are ambitious, if you're in the music industry, if you're ambitious, period.
Mm-hmm.
You're competitive and you're ambitious. It's completely in our nature to be that way.
Right.
Right. I do my best to run my race with blinders on.
Oh, well, yeah.
Because I have seen so many writers go up and down. Like, you know, it's funny, like new writers pop up and you're like, yeah, this is like, you know, I remember you when your name was this 5 years ago.
Sure.
Like being there almost 10 years, I've seen like three or four crops of writers come and go. Sure. And the fact that I still am able to write on records, and some years are better and some years are down and some years are back up. And I understand the roller coaster. I mean, even look at JR, who's on an upswing again now, but like, you know, was down and like it, you know, Luke's had moments that he's been down. Max has had quiet moments. Yeah. Pharrell's had a quiet decade, I think, you know, and like people, you know, that's just the nature of the industry. You know, you go in and out, and that's just, I think if you can accept that and you just keep focused on what you believe and trying to make yourself better and trying to evolve and trying to work with new people and, you know, figuring out what makes them fresh and new and adapting that and creating it and borrowing it for yourself and not worrying about what other people are doing and understanding that like, that's their path. I mean, you could sit there and go like, people always have these massive ups and downs. Like, you know, all of a sudden you have like 6 hits in 1 year, 5 hits the next year, and then no hits the 3rd year. And you're like, I prefer to have like one or two hits a year. Just ride a smaller wavelength. I don't want to have like the six hits in 1 year because I don't want to have the no hits the next year. You know, I'd rather keep it even right. For my sanity, for my like waking up and not feeling riddled with anxiety moment.
Yeah, but did you know that?
I would rather just be like, you know what? Things will be okay.
Did you know that after SOS?
No, because it was my stepdad said to me, he goes, don't leave the agency. And I was like, wow. Why? And he goes, because you may never have a hit song again. I was like, thanks, Dad. Right. You know, it was like,
that was the third song I've ever written. Like, before we get to that, because that's kind of interesting, I just have to ask about Halo, how you go from writing, you know, Sean Kingston, SOS, are real poppy songs, and then you write like maybe the biggest song of your career.
Yeah. So Ryan and I would write sometimes, but he was busy with his band stuff. And then
this is after Apologize, so. Right?
Yeah.
Around Apologize.
Yeah, yeah. But to Apologize on Timbaland's album.
Yeah.
On the Timbaland
album. Right. But he's just done, you know, so he's doing Apologize. He's now the biggest. He went from.
He's hot new writer. He's like the hot guy and whatever like that. So I'm writing with him sometimes, but he's on the road a lot supporting One Republic, right? And I don't know what to do. So I'm writing with Greg, and he had introduced me to this demo singer friend of his, this kid, DQ.
Right.
And so DQ and I started writing like every day. And we became like basically writing partners for the better, for, you know, lack of better or whatever. And we started the writing camp together, which was just a collective of us, of a bunch of writers together at the time. Sure. We just called it the writing camp, right? And in the meantime, you know, I would write with Ryan when I could.
Right.
Ryan's on tour and he's in Michigan and he's playing basketball on an off day and he like ruptures his Achilles.
I remember that.
Like shattered it.
Yeah.
Playing basketball.
Yeah.
And so they had to go into surgery there and they had to cancel the rest of the tour. Yeah. And they flew him back to LA. And his first day back in LA, Genevieve went to work. And, you know, Ryan was like, you know, on crutches and had to keep his leg elevated and all this other stuff.
I was emailing him every day because he was like, hey, I'll sing the hook on Save Some. And that was like that era.
Oh, was it?
Really? Yeah. I just remember going to his apartment and he's got his huge cast on.
Where was that? On the block away from Highland.
Right. It's like right
Wilshire
and
Highland.
Right now.
Highland. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I canceled my session and said I went and got La Scala. I brought like over like salads. I was like, I'm gonna come hang with you, man. Keep you company while Genevieve goes to work or whatever. So like she's like, bye, you know, rest and all that stuff. She closes the door. Ryan's like, come on, let's go write. I'm like, dude. You're supposed to be resting. He's like, no. He gets up on his crutches and like hobbles into his studio room, whatever. Yeah. He sits down there, and he's like, let's write something for Beyonce. Like Jay Brown wants something for Beyonce, and I was like, cool. And you know, and we were sitting there, and I was like, you know, what we should write. I was like, let's write like Ray LaMontagne's Shelter, but like for Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Yeah.
And like he puts his hands down on the keyboard, and it was the Angelic Patch, and I was like, you know, like I'll like. Keep you safe, like, you know, like a halo. And he kind of like looked at me and we were like,
cool.
Yeah, let's write that. Yeah. And then 3 hours later, we had the song.
Right.
Minus the bridge.
Right.
He sent the song to Jay. An hour later, Jay wrote back and said, please hold this. Don't do anything with it. I love it.
And Ryan sang the demo because he's got.
Ryan sang the demo.
I think people underestimate how great of a voice he has.
Also,
like his voice can sell. He's got that thing.
Also, he's the Apologize guy.
Right.
People, writers were calling me, like McKeeb and all these people were like, dude, you got to hook me up with the Apologize guy. Like no one knew Ryan yet.
Right.
He was like the crazy dope song from the Timbaland album. I want to write with that
guy. And this is, I think Apologize came first and then Bleeding Love
of course.
Knocks off his own song at number one or something.
Yeah. So. Which was a Jesse McCartney song.
Right.
So the next day we decide, we're going to have you know, we go out to eat that night, to go out to dinner with Ashley and Genevieve.
Sure.
And, you know, Ryan's like, dude, it's a smash, right? The song's a smash. And I'm like, it's really good. And he's like, dude, it's a smash. I was like, I can't say that, man.
Yeah. I mean, there's that thing.
I just can't do that.
It's only a smash in retrospect.
It is, but I knew there was something special about it, but I didn't want to, I just couldn't say it.
Right.
It was too, you know, whatever. So the next day we said, let's write a bridge. They love it. There's no bridge. Let's write a bridge. So we came back in and we spent 3 hours, the entire length that wrote us the rest of the song, writing a bridge.
Right.
And in the bridge, we actually, the original bridge, he has like a part that he's like, you will shelter me and I will shelter you. Like it was like a paid homage to Ray. Right. Like, you know, we were like, it's a very clever bridge, right, which no longer exists. She ripped it out of the song, right, and did her opera thing.
It's probably,
which was way better than our bridge, right? Right? Right. You're like, damn, why didn't we think of the opera thing? Right? Like,
it's probably a good thing that,
And
nowadays, it, like, if people knew that inspired you, that would bring a whole other.
Well, I mean, there's nothing in the song that sounds like it. So you
sure? I totally get that.
Yeah, it wasn't like we were inspired by Ray. Like you're being sued. It's not. Right, it wasn't like right. It's not close to Shelter. Right. It was just like what it, we were drawing from the concept of Shelter.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That being said, had we left the bridge in with that line,
that would be the thing.
So we may have been screwed.
Right. So,
but yeah, so she pulled that out. She added a word to the song.
Right.
Which to this day, I still don't understand how we didn't write that word.
What was the word?
It rhymed. Like we left an unrhymed sentence open and she just added a word that rhymed. She's like, gravity can't begin. Our demo goes, to pull me back to the ground. She added again.
Yeah, right.
How did we not think of that?
Right.
Like, it's the most, like, bizarre thing. Like, can't begin to pull me back to the ground again. Yeah, of course. Duh. Like, we left it ground.
Why'd you do that?
I don't know. If you look back and listen to the demo of Ryan singing, I'm like, why did we not say again?
Do you ever listen back to that demo?
Yeah.
And it's weird. This is that thing where when you write at home and you have an acoustic guitar, piano, and you're writing with somebody, you haven't really produced out the record, maybe you put a couple drums down, shit like that. And then the song becomes a worldwide, you know, a real smash. Like the kind of song, to me, Halo's the, you know, I remember when you were telling this story where you were in a meeting and somebody said to you, put on Halo and said, this is just to remind you.
Yeah, Marty Bandier.
Yeah, this dude, is to remind best, you of what you can do.
That was the best, like best and like, I mean, funny. I thought it was funny. I mean, it was meant as like a jab. Maybe it was tongue in cheek. Marty's a tongue in cheek.
I think it's a tongue in cheek thing.
Yeah,
because you do write that in a tiny room.
Yeah,
and you think this is a and you guys are out and later Ryan's saying this is a smash and you're saying I don't know if I can say that yet. And then if you were to walk down the street, I think it's one thing when you say all the people you've written with. It's another thing to say I wrote Halo. Even if you say, I wrote SOS, there's probably, you know, the Rihanna song sometimes. That's a big song. But, you know, that song, the fact that you can say Halo is the same thing as saying Umbrella or, you know, it's like, it's a massive copyright. It's crazy. I mean, I imagine that still comes up.
I would love
constantly
to write another one, but I'd be happy. I'd be okay if.
There's a, you know, the author from Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
She does this TED talk where she talks about what happens when you try to write after you've written your biggest success. You know that she knows that she's not going to beat Eat, Pray, Love. It was so big, was made into a movie. And what is the emotional approach to following up what is clearly going to be an impossible thing to match? You have to write something totally different, which you've done.
Different and successful in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's where...
I mean, you can't...
Tonight for Hashel
Ray. I was going to say, you can't like, put Halo and Tonight in the same world, but yet Tonight technically had more radio success than Halo.
Oh, yeah. I'm right? not surprised.
It's not, it doesn't even like nearly come close to the cultural impact.
Right.
But the song itself is over like 500,000 spins at radio to date. Like, it's like, it's a massive radio song that, you know, went top five at pop and number one at Hot AC. It was multi-format, recurrent.
Yeah.
You know, synced to high heaven.
I mean, I bet.
But you would never, no one ever like walked down the aisle to Tonight or like, you know, they don't perform Tonight at like a Haiti relief concert, you know, like.
That's so funny.
You know, it doesn't have the cultural impact.
And that's the thing.
You wouldn't be nominated for Grammys.
You've had so many songs that have been secretly very successful. You know, I think It Girl.
Yeah.
Is kind of nuts.
Should have been way more successful.
Or Take You There, even the Sean Kingston. These were pretty big records.
Yeah,
that
they're all top tens.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. But there is something about, to me, I think Halo's just it's hard to beat it. It's like Tonight is actually really impressive. The fact that it broke a band. I mean, Savin said that to me once, where he was talking about how with One Direction and with Cher Lloyd, how no matter how many hits you have with Usher and with Britney and all that, you're just another song for them.
Yeah.
But if you can break an artist,
that's the golden keys.
Because after tonight, you then have the ability to sign MKTO. You have the ability to really Boardwalk ends up getting probably more credibility too.
And then the E-Man partnership solidifies, and me and E-Man and Lindy go on a run and write a bunch of stuff together. And
so with you and E-Man, is that it? I mean, Boardwalk is not E-Man. That's separate.
That was prior to.
Right. And so the stuff that you do with E-Man, ZZ's Boardwalk.
Boardwalk.
And how do you define, like, how are you able to balance all of it? I mean, being a writer, having Boardwalk, having your relationship with E-Man, do you feel like that you have enough time in a day?
No, never. What are you talking about?
I don't know. Yeah, but I mean, but that's the thing. I mean, at some point you have to prioritize. How do you prioritize?
It's tough. You just have to. Like, you know, I mean, I feel like I try to balance writing. You know, it's really hard. For instance, like, the last quarter of last year and the first half of this year was spent working almost completely on like 3 or 4 projects.
Right.
You know, and the second half of this year has been spent almost completely writing for other projects, which has resulted and always has resulted in way better results.
Right.
Right. All of a sudden, like, songs are being cut.
Sure.
People are calling you into projects. People are like, oh, yeah. So, Evan's not just doing his self-contained thing.
No, when but, you do but this for self-contained a
minute,
thing.
For a minute, but if those artists blow up,
right,
the reward
is
so much greater than having a cut on
Jason Derulo,
Zayn Malik, you know, or having a cut on Rachel Platten, or having a cut on even Usher, or someone who's like an established heritage artist, right?
Right.
It's so much bigger to have your own. Because, like, the Jason Derulo factor, like you said.
But you saw what, I mean.
But you saw what it did for
JR. You saw what it did also. That if, and when you're on that, when that second Jason album doesn't do so well.
Great.
The second Sean album all of a sudden doesn't do well, you're out for a year.
You pull yourself out of the game.
Yeah.
So I think there was a quick shift to, okay, I see where this is going. I've seen it with other people already. I'm not going to be a victim to that. Let's start really writing for a lot of projects right now, and just, you know, remind people that you exist, because, like, out of sight, out of mind in this business, more than 9 months.
Do you and E-Man write together with these other people, or are you writing with other
both
outside?
Yeah. Both, you know. I mean, E-Man and I have really great chemistry, so we have, like, a bunch of writers who will come in and write with us.
Sure.
Or artists that'll come in.
Yeah.
But, you know, we both write, we don't write exclusively with each other.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, I have to say that it's pretty cool because, you know, you look back at 2007, and the first thing I was going to mention was that there's an email from me to you checking in on these songs, because you gave me a CD of tracks from JR, and you were the one who said, you should write to these, you'd be good at this, and you said you and Ryan were, you know, when you heard some of the glacier hiking stuff, you thought that I'd be good at writing pop stuff and I should probably do that. And I remember
how did that turn out for you?
Obviously, pretty well. I mean, it's insane. I mean, that's a really cool thing. I think of you guys kind of as, you know,
We're your Eskimos.
You're my Eskimos.
As they say in, like, AA, the person who brought you in from the cold is your Eskimo.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love that, because that's sort of what it is, and I don't talk to Ryan very often, and I don't know if he'd realize that he has that kind of influence, but when you're in a band and you're trying to figure out LA, and the one band we're playing with is One Republic, and my booking agent writes a number one song, and both you guys are like, you should get into this. This would be good for you. You think, well, this is kind of interesting. You start
like, is life? This is the weirdest shit ever.
I mean, I'm starting to not enjoy my band, and I'm starting to think, well, there is this part of the music
industry.
Were we
at I feel like we were at next to a Color Me Mine or something. Were we sitting at a Coffee Bean or a Rosti Chicken or
probably
something?
Probably.
On South Beverly Drive.
That's probably right. Yeah. It's just a strange concept. And then to think that now we're sitting sort of as peers and then I stuck with it. And then I ended up doing well enough that like it being part of the family, and then to have us then co-write together on occasion, and to be, I mean, the trail of people connected by you and me is just out of control now. I mean, we just are part of the same group. Of course,
yeah.
And it's just so strange to be, I'm going to be in a band, and you're going to be like, I'm going to try being an agent after being a drug addict. And it,
professionally.
Professional drug addict. No, but to go and be in this situation where, what are the odds that we're sitting here having a conversation 9 years later, and be, what a crazy 9 years. Just out of control to think that's where we were.
The same depressing odds that in 9 years from now, we might not be sitting here.
That's true. That's like, an amazing way to end this.
It's like a horrible, let's all go cry now. No, I don't, who knows? Like, I could be living in Japan 9 years from now.
Sure.
You could
be totally.
You could be running for Congress. Like, yeah. I don't, like, who knows? Like, right?
Well, I want to, you know,
I mean, 9 years is like literally a lifetime. If you look back at the fact that 9 years ago, SOS came out, it feels like forever.
Yeah.
And also somehow feels like it's yesterday.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silberstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.